So let me carry on talking about the A model and B model. Let me finish off what I was hoping to finish off last time. So let me do a quick preview of the A model. So this is one of the two topological field theories which I was talking about last time. It depends on B plus ij, that is the complexified Kähler form of the target space, and it's independent of the complex structure. Now, half of my fermions I turned into scalars or zero forms, and I've given those the name chi superscript I, where I just shows that these take values in the pullback of the tangent bundle. Now, we introduce a set of local operators, which I'm going to write basically as a polynomial in terms of these zero forms. So let me do one term in the polynomial, which I'll write as okay. So that's just some products of the fermions. And this is going to correspond to a vertex operator of an open string. But that detail needn't concern us too much, but that's what it would be in the physical language. So let me use the notation W for a corresponding P form. It's a P form. Then there's a simple relationship. The anti-commutator of Q with this open string vertex operator is just minus the corresponding vertex operator with D of that P form. Now, it's in this sense that the Q cohomology is Durham cohomology. The action of the BRST operator is exactly the same as D acting on P forms. So I write down these so-called open string vertex operators, which are polynomials in terms of the fermions, but then I just replace the fermions by one forms. Then the anti-commutator of the BRST operator amounts to the same thing as D, the boundary. So in the A model, Q cohomology is the same thing as Durham cohomology. For two forms, we have correlation functions. I can take three open string vertex operators, and I can work out what the correlation function of those three vertex operators is. And it's simply the integral of A wedge B wedge C integrated over the target space X plus some instanton correction. Which are associated with things such as rational curves. At least for low degrees, these things really are rational curves. There are some subtleties. If you read Sheldon Katz's book, you'll find out all kinds of weird things about these instanton corrections. But the important thing here is that this is the leading term, and there are some instanton corrections to this three-point function. And this idea basically tells us that the second Durham cohomology generates what's called the quantum cohomology ring. Okay. Wasn't quite as good with using space on the blackboard as I wanted. I want my A model on this blackboard and the B model on that blackboard. Let me squeeze in Now, we want to add the debrained. And I mentioned right at the end of last time that the things that I called A-brains are entirely consistent with the way that I twisted my topological field theory. So the debrains that I can add in are A-brains. I cannot add B-brains into the A-model because the B-brains are inconsistent with the topological twist that I did. But I can introduce the A-brains. So what I'm going to consider these A-brains are flat vector bundles where M is a special Lagrangian submanifold. And then I can then write down what will correspond to open string vertex operators. These things are the closed strings. On the boundaries associated with these special Lagrangian submanifolds, I can consider open string vertex operators. And you can show, Witten showed back in 1991, that these again correspond to Durham cohomology. It's only the Durham cohomology of the submanifold, and it takes values in the endomorphisms of this vector bundle E. I don't have time to go through the proof of that. Yep. I'm assuming it's a complex vector bundle, so a UN bundle, if you want to look at the compact subgroup, yeah. Yeah, sure. Yeah. Well, that was when you turn on the B field and things like that, isn't it? Oh. Well, I don't want to get too involved with the A-brain story anyway, so I may have missed a subtlety, but I don't really care for the rest of these talks. I'm just saying the leading order idea that Witten put forward in 1991. If there's something slightly wrong with this...
Well, no, those weren't stable anyway.
Oh, okay. Right, I mean... I don't really want to get too involved in this because I'm not going to use this fact anyway. I'm just mentioning it briefly here. So there might be a question mark about whether these things are exact. I mean, there are all kinds of problems with the A model from the fact that there are instanton corrections, and that might be where a problem's coming from. But classically, this should be true because there was nothing wrong with Witten's analysis back in 1991 if you look at things in a semi-classical limit. Okay. Well, I'm happy to say that there's something slightly wrong with this, but as I said, I'm not using this in the rest of these talks, so I'll just leave it there. actually, what's interesting about this construction of Witten back in 1991 was that this was pre-1995, so it was before people were thinking about D-brains, but Witten still did this construction. Anyway. Okay, so that's the A model. Now let me write down anything similar for the B model. So this depends on complex structure. It's independent of B plus IJ. My zero forms, I didn't write down last time what these fermions look like. I'm going to make one with an anti-holomorphic index from one linear combination of my size, and I'm going to make one with a lower holomorphic index with the other linear combination of the size. Okay. Now my closed string operators are now going to look like a little bit more complicated this time. Oops, these aren't barred. So now let V be a corresponding form that this is going to take values in the tangent bundle. So I'm going to use my d5s. For the anti-holomorphic indices, then I'm going to use things in the holomorphic tangent bundle for the J indices. So this is a let me describe it like this. It's something to do with Dolbeau cohomology. It's a Q form, but it's living in the anti-symmetrized products of the cotangent bundle. Okay, so that's where that form lives. So P is the number of J indices, and
what's eta I 1, eta I 2?
Have I done something wrong?
Eta, I
oh yeah, eta, yeah, eta there. There we go. Right. Well, these are what Witten calls the local operators, which correspond to points on the world sheet. So this is an open string vertex operator that corresponds to inserting an open string at a point. There are other observables, but Witten calls them non-local because they look like one forms on the world sheet. Therefore, you've got to integrate them over some curve or something on the world sheet to get an operator. So Witten kind of waves his arms a bit and says that these are the only things that you just that you naturally associate to points on the world sheet. Yeah. Absolutely, yeah, right. But I'm just looking at the closed string operators that correspond to inserting a string at a point. Okay. Where was I? So now we can try and do the same trick here. Then, well, not surprisingly, the anti-commutator with the Q this time gives me minus x d bar v. So what I get this time is Dolbeau cohomology. Taking values in some products of the holomorphic tangent bundle. I can again do my product if A, B, and C are in kind of like I need a 1 minus 1 form here. So the basic operators are going to be elements of this group, and then the correlation function between three operators is A wedge, B wedge, CK wedge, the holomorphic 3 form, and I need to contract these indices which are associated with the tangent bundle with another copy of the holomorphic 3 form, where I've lowered the indices by using the Kähler metric. So if you like, I've taken omega bar here with so this thing is omega bar I J K G I bar G J J bar G K K bar. Okay, so you just do the obvious thing. The only way the indices can really be turned into something invariant. Okay. These functions here?
Yeah, the D5s here. Could they be anti-holomorphic?
These are anti-holomorphic.
Yeah, but they'll work.
Yeah, I mean, just think of it as DZ bar. It's the anti-holomorphic version of the, it's the anti-holomorphic one form. Okay, now we want to add D brains. And as I said, the only consistent brains I can add are the ones which are of interest to us, the B brains. So the first guess, the first naive guess that you do would be flat vector bundles over complex submanifolds. And I probably could. Well, these are one forms valued in the tangent bundle. So I've got a one form there. I then wedge with a three form. So this whole thing is a six form. This is not a form because this is the coefficient in front of something that would be a form. Oh, sorry. Well, it's a wedge for a zero form. Right. I can put a wedge there if I want. Okay. So. You could try and build it up with flat vector bundles, and there might be a way of doing it. But Witten had a good idea back in 1991, and we're going to copy him. Instead of considering flat vector bundles over complex submanifolds, we're going to consider just vector bundles over the whole so. I'm not going to consider submanifolds. I'm just going to consider the whole space and put vector bundles over the whole space. But I'm going to modify my topological quantum field theory so it can cope with vector bundles with curvature. Let me just say holomorphic vector bundles, i.e. the curvature is a type 1-1. And you can do that, and Witten did that. There's the way of modifying the topological quantum field theory, so indeed I can cope fine with non-flat vector bundles, just as long as they're holomorphic vector bundles, i.e. the curvature is a 1-1 form. So that's what we do there. And the open string vertex operators, are in a 0, comma q forms valued in the endomorphism of V. Whenever we go to open string vertex operators, we kind of lose half the degrees of freedom that we thought we had. In the topological limit, when you look at the way that the operator restricts to the boundary, the effect in the A brain was to restrict the P forms to only live on the submanifold M. The half loss of freedom here is that this first number is zero. I lose all the fermions which were called theta. But again, I don't have time to go through the details of that, but for some magical reason, this first number has to be zero. Sorry, I didn't quite hear that. Well, the reflection matrix R was only giving me the information about the submanifold, not about the bundle on the submanifold. Right. I mean, the order of logic I've used, I've kind of cheated a little bit. the way that Witten managed to construct the A brains and B brains in his topological field theory, he never actually went through the the story which I went through in the last lecture. He just looked at some subspaces which would satisfy the equations of motion. Right. That's an interesting question, because certainly the formalism I used, Witten does have to change the topological field theory to allow for a curvature of this bundle. So something non-trivial has happened here. I don't know right now how to go back and put that back into the language that I was using in yesterday's talk. I'd have to think about that. So this is our story for, this is our first attempt at a topological field theory for deep brains. In particular, this is the story of the B brain. Our B brains, our first guess is going to be that the B brain covers the entire space. It's going to be a complex holomorphic vector bundle, and the open string vertex operators, which correspond to an insertion of an open string with these boundary conditions, will correspond to this. Now, this is one D brain. This is one vector bundle over the entire space. This end E, E is a single vector bundle. Now, the first thing I want to do now is to extend this language so I can cope with more than one D brain. No, I mean two logically different vector bundles. So this vector bundle can have a rank bigger than one. There's no problem with that. Sure, yeah, I agree that there's a problem with the formalism that I was, I mean, that formalism I was using yesterday was to motivate the idea of complex submanifolds versus the slags which I've got here. Right, so forget that you were that we were using that motivation for the and just use the topological field theory, which I've now got. Okay, so just think in terms of the topological field theory.
I mean, the modification which allows you to consider non-flat holomorphic vector bundles on all of X, doesn't that same modification allow you to consider non-flat holomorphic vector bundles on holomorphic submanifolds of X? It's the same cure that you do directly.
Well, anyway, all I'm using is the topological field theory from now on, so let me get away with just using this language that I've introduced here, rather than trying to relate it to what I was doing. I mean, this whole series of talks, it's the way you learn physics in high school. Every year you learn that the previous year's story was wrong. I'm going to give you more and more accurate stories about what a deep brain is as these lectures go on.
Just to make sure I understand, so the number Q there corresponds to the dimension of the brain, is that right?
The dimension of the brain for the is always 3 here, and it's always 6 here.
So you're not considering things on.
Okay. Right. This was the first question: was is it flat vector bundles over complex manifolds? And I'm saying no. I'm gonna restrict myself by only having vector bundles over the entire space, and then I'm gonna compensate for that restriction by allowing curvature. I mean.
But you're really thinking.
At the moment, I'm doing, yeah, right now I'm doing that, but that restriction is going to not be that bad, actually, we'll find that soon. Because allowing for curvature kind of brings in the lower brains. You can think of the first churn class of the bundle as being somehow the 4 brains, the second churn class as being the 2 brains, etc. So they're kind of hiding there in the curvature, and that's what we'll find later on. So, all I've described so far, let me think in terms of the A brains where I've actually got a submanifold. All I've described so far is an open string that ends, that both of its ends are on the same D brain. What if I had 2 slags? And I had an open string that started on one D brain and ended on the other one. That's what we need to consider next. And let's do this first in the language of A brains, because this is easier to imagine, because I've literally got a subspace for A brains. For B brains, it's confusing because the vector bundles are on top of each other. So at one end of the string, which is sigma is 0, I have a special Lagrangian condition. So this is the volume form, and this is 0. At the other end of the string, I have another special Lagrangian condition, but the phase needn't be the same. Now, these boundary conditions, these boundary conditions are what the open string oscillators can do. The way that you look at what the open string is doing depends on this, on these real numbers A and B. So, if e to the IA equals e to the IB, then we have, roughly speaking, integral oscillator modes. On the open string. And if this is not true, then we do not have integral oscillator modes. So moving these values of A and B moves all the modes of the string up and down. The relative value of A and B give a big change as to what this open string looks like. Well, if you just look at, I mean, it's fairly easy to imagine that, I mean, if you think of just, say, a sine wave, then if I fix the sine wave as being zero at one end, it's not too difficult to show that the phase at the other end has to be pretty much A minus B. I mean, it's just the formalism. If you just literally write down the string modes, what I've done, that's exactly what's going to happen. That the modes are just going to be shifted by the A minus B. Okay. So introduce a number I'm going to call Xi, which is going to play a big role in these talks, which is A minus B. So A is in the region, it's greater than or equal to 0 and less than 2. Now, if, again, I don't have time to prove this, if Xi is not equal to 0, space-time supersymmetry is destroyed. Again, these statements aren't very hard to prove, but it just take me a long time to go through the formalism of strings, so I'll let you prove these things as a homework exercise if you. Now, in particular, this statement that if Xi is zero, space-time supersymmetry is okay. And this goes back to some old work by Bacuse, Douglas, and Lee, where they showed that you can therefore put these A brains at various angles, and supersymmetry may or may not be broken.
Well, yeah. Question,
like,
what is space-time supersymmetry in this context?
Well, one of the D brains by themselves would break. Oh, I guess I've gone back to my untwisted theory at this point, I guess. Yeah, I should have mentioned that. At this point, I'm back in my untwisted theory. You see, I mean, A brains and B brains don't depend on topological field theory. They exist in intrinsically. Okay. I should have mentioned, well, everything I was saying about the oscillators, I mean, that doesn't make sense in topological field theory anyway. I should have said, I've gone back to my untwisted topological field theory now. Okay. So this number psi, which kind of measures in some sense the angle between these two brains, at first sight looks as if it lives between 0 and 2, basically. Now, one of the most important steps that we do in this this language is that I'm going to claim, and we'll see this very explicitly in an example I'll give later, that the only consistent way that I can describe D brains over the whole moduli space is if I allow this relative difference of A and B to actually go outside this range of 0 going to 2. So I choose a base point, say, in the moduli space. I start at a certain point in the moduli space, and I say that all my relative differences of these angles, xi, are going to be within this range 0 going to 2. I start at a certain point in the moduli space and say that's true. Now, as I vary, in this case, say, the complex structure of the moduli space, these brains are going to bend round and around, and the relative values of A and B might be such that I actually go outside this range of 0 to 2. So even if I fix a base point and try and get this relative difference to be between 0 and 2 in some parts of the moduli space, there's no way I can cover the entire moduli space and keep this relative value of xi in that region. So I'm going to allow xi to actually live on the whole real line. But bearing in mind that this did depend on the choice of base point, I have to start somewhere and say this is where I'm going to fix my xi as being between 0 and 2, and then it can go outside that range further on in the moduli space. It really is the Teichmuller space. It's the Teichmuller space. I can get this difference to go absolutely huge by winding round and round points. I can walk round in circles around the moduli space and get this to ramp all the way up.
Do you claim that unwrapping the psi is already taking you to the universal?
Absolutely, yeah, right. But even if I stay in one of the universal. I want the universal cover here, I'm fairly sure. But even if I look at one fundamental region of the moduli space, I still claim that I can get this distance to go outside too. And I'll give an example of that later on.
So is there physics in the value of psi as opposed to pi psi? Pi r psi?
Not really, but, well, yes, there is, I should say. It all depends on the choice of base point, which amounts to your interpretation of what large radius physics is. So if I didn't have a bias towards thinking of things in terms of large radius, the answer would be no, there is no physics in taking this outside the range 0 to 2. But if I implicitly choose a base point, such as biasing myself to what large radius physics is, I'm going to find that I need to let this range outside 0 to 2.
But I'm just trying to figure out what, well, maybe you're going to tell us what the implication is of
I'm going to give an example, yeah. I'm going to show you something later in these talks which needs this to go outside the value 0 to 2. It has no interpretation if you keep this range inside 0 to 2. And it does exist as a physical object. So, in that, sorry?
A topological string theory.
No, it's a physical one because I'll also show it's stable.
Is A defined modulo
pi or modulo 2 pi? A is defined modulo 2 pi. So I've chosen a funny normalization of 2 here. You might have wanted to put 1 over 2 pi, which...
If you replace A by A plus pi, you're changing into the IN omega, but you're not changing its reality. So be careful about that.
I would consider that to be a different slag because the volume form is positive.
So you do distinguish it?
Absolutely, yeah. Okay. This is non-topological. Yeah. It's special Lagrangian for the. It is true that the topological field theory doesn't know about this omega. That's why it was terrible that I omitted to state that I'd gone back to a non-topological field theory. I don't see the problem because we know that topological field theory is a blunter tool than non-topological field theory. So the fact that topological field theory is giving me a weaker constraint than non-topological field theory is the right way around.
But the question is, do you expect there to be many more in-brain states in topological theory, or at the end of the day, are these, for example, identified?
I expect to have a lot more states which are possible D-brains in the topological field theory than there are physically. And we'll see that for the B-brains. As I said, I'm not going to analyze the details of the A-brains, but I'm going to try and explain as much about the B-brains as possible. And you'll see that the topological field theory has a highly infinite number more possible B-brains than the untwisted theory has. Well, but the B side is already terrible. I mean, I can't see that the A side is that much worse. Well, you're getting me down. I mean, you're making me go down the path of discussing the details of A-brains again, which I don't really want to do. I admit that A-brains are a very complicated story. I just want to use some naive pictures for A-brains. So, when you go into these detailed pictures of A-brains again, I don't want to go down that path in these talks. I know, and I said. Good, fine. I mean, that's exactly what I'd expect, that the topological theory is much weaker than the non-topological theory when constraining what the possible D-brains can be.
The physical theory has
trillions of D-brains.
I mean, all sorts of excited states,
different
ground states that you might...
Oh, okay. I'm just looking at...
and so usually the topological theory is...
No, I'm restricting to what you'd think of as the chiral ring analog of what the D-brains are. So I'm not looking at any of the excited state.
You're sort of saying to me, for the A-brains, that these are just overlapping sets, that the topological theory is giving you some subset of the D-brains of the physical theory.
Right, I mean, we're not going to analyze A-brains in detail in this talk, but the B-brains I will, and I'm explicitly going to show exactly what are the extra D-brains that you got from the topological field theory that you've got to get rid of to go back to the untwisted theory.
I think you could address this question maybe most directly by saying you could formulate topological theory based on Lagrangian D-brains, and you would get that any Lagrangian cycle in the same Hamiltonian deformation class will give you the same answer. So this is like choosing a particular representative, which is like what Shah was saying, choosing a random representative.
Yeah. What I don't like about this conversation is that we're getting into details of A-brains, and I explicitly want to avoid getting into details of A-brains.
You're thinking about B-brains, right?
Right. My purpose, in fact, I said this basically, I want to exploit A-brains to analyze B-brains. Okay. So just use the simple picture of A-brains and don't worry about the details. Okay. Is it about A-brains?
Well, I think, isn't the problem with the topological theory, if you want to describe these BS brains, you certainly want to impose that condition.
Right.
Now, in the topological theory, you lose that condition because you impose the condition on the current, not on the false mass, into the I-pi, or pi false mass. Is there a way to sort of include this other generator, sort of the spectrum supersymmetry generator,
There is no way that the topological field theory can know what these A's and B's are, because one of the properties of the A model is that it doesn't know what the complex structure is, and the complex structure determines what A and B are. So there's at least no basic way that you could ever hope that the topological field theory could see what these A's and B's are. Okay, but that's a different topological field theory. Sure, I could make the topological field theory so it did depend on complex structure, which
has some analog of this condition. It doesn't involve omega, so it does require particular choice of omega. Right. Which doesn't depend on complex structure, but still
some A-brain. You don't just totally really complex structure, so you have
much smaller set.
Well, okay.
Hang
on to A-brains.
Maybe it's the analysis that led to Lagrange and some animals was sort of classical.
Absolutely, right. Which
if you look at instant non-correctness to the topological theory, you could ask whether they impose further restrictions on what sort of boundaries.
But I know it can't possibly know about the complex structure, so it can't give the slag condition. Okay.
Will you please lecture about B-brains?
Right. Very good. Okay. So now I've got my untwisted theory of more than one A-brain. I want to go back to the topological field theory. So I want to twist this and go back to my topological field theory. Now, there might be a way of twisting this untwisted theory so I get back a topological field theory when I break space-time supersymmetry. But it's going to be a very funny-looking topological field theory, and I don't really understand the details of it. So what I'm going to do instead is only allow myself to twist the original theory if my space-time supersymmetry was there. So only consider I'm going to place that restriction in, which implies, therefore, that epsilon has to be twice an integer. So my topological field theory, even though I introduced this psi, which at first looked like it was on a circle and I made it a real line, now it's just a series of points on the real line. I'm also going to introduce anti-brains. Which is thought of as brains, pretty much with the sign of the volume form flipped. So I just change if the orientation of the brain is changed. I'm replacing a brain by an anti-brain. So I'm changing a goes to a plus pi. If I include these anti-brains, I mean, this is just a formal step, I'm not really doing anything clever here, it means that I can now have a combination of brains and anti-brains which don't break supersymmetry, such that the relative size are actually odd numbers. So the rule is, if psi is odd between two brains, one of them has to be an anti-brain. Exactly one of them. If the relative psi is even, then they're either both brains or both the opposite orientation, the anti-brains. Okay? No, that's exactly what the condition is for breaking supersymmetry. That psi, I mean, this is what the...
No, but a zero grade and an anti-zero grade sitting next to each other, or a p grade and an anti-p grade sitting next to each other, is not a supersymmetry of ground state, unless, as I said, you need some sort of sense of
Well, I'm I'm talking about the A brains here. I haven't told you how to compute what this psi is for the points. The
brain the
no, they differ. If I just bring them together in a naive sense, then this is where it gets complicated. That I consider to be a brain and anti-brain whose psi is differing by zero, therefore it breaks the supersymmetry. It's too parallel. This is a confusing issue. I've got to take a
brain and an anti-brain, isn't there?
Right, which is why it's breaking supersymmetry. And if it's the same slag that they're on, then obviously A is the same for that slag. So therefore psi is zero. So I've got a brain anti-brain pair differing by zero. Therefore, by my rules, it's broken supersymmetry, which is what it should have done.
If you take an anti-brain on a cycle with psi z, it's three.
Okay.
And isn't there a transformation that does nothing to the physics where you turn that into a brain and shift psi by
one?
By one.
Absolutely. So and that's exactly what I'm doing here. Right. And that's all I'm saying here, that shifting psi by... Right, that's right. So shifting psi by one is the same thing as turning a brain into an anti-brain. That's all I'm saying here. Right. So therefore, two of them still don't break... Well, it's the same thing, just saying that A is even... Yeah, I'm just saying that if it's... This is a confusing point, I can see. But literally, a brain and an anti-brain wrapped around the same slag break supersymmetry because their size differ by zero. A brain wrapped around the slag and an anti-brain wrapped around the opposite slag would be the thing that doesn't break supersymmetry, but that's the same thing as two brains wrapped around the slag. Okay?
So if I have a brain A equals zero, and then a brain with A equals to pi.
Fine.
Does it break supersymmetry?
No. Because the anti-brain with A is pi is exactly the same thing as the brain with A is zero. So you've got two identical brains, if that's what you're going to say. No, but I'm identifying A mod 2 pi, but then I'm saying that a shift of A by pi is the same thing as turning a brain into an anti-brain. Yep. That breaks supersymmetry. No, because what he was a brain with A is zero and an anti-brain with A is pi. That does not break supersymmetry. Right. None of you interpreted in the way that I'm saying. Right. That's exactly what I'm doing. Right, that's exactly what I'm doing. Right. Absolutely, right. That's exactly what I'm saying.
Are anti-brains the only way of getting C to be an odd integer?
In this context, while I'm insisting on not breaking supersymmetry, yes. Okay. So that's the first thing that I'm going to say is that my topological field theory, I associate, so in the topological field theory, I associate some integers with my D brains. the integers playing the role of a over pi and b over pi. Now I claim, well, I don't have time to do it, I certainly don't have time to do it now. These integers are associated with the ghost number. I'll explain exactly what I mean by that. Ghost numbers. I'll explain exactly what I mean by the following. So if I have two A brains, one with an integer m, one with an integer n, and I have a open string vertex operator going from it, and suppose this open string vertex operator was an element of h 0 comma q, well, the other thing that I need to do, I hope this is fairly obvious. If I have a vector bundle E on here and a vector bundle F on there, what I actually do is replace ENDT by E dual tensor F. That's the thing that's going to play the role of the endomorphism. So rather than mapping a D brain to itself, I'm mapping now one D brain to another D brain. So that's the thing I'm going to use there. And the ghost number equals, well, the ghost number in the theory without brains was simply Q. This Q measured what the ghost number was. Now, because of this difference of M and M, I need to modify it in that way. Okay. Now, for those of you who don't know conformal field theory, or topological field theory, all I'm going to do is think of a ghost number as an integer that's only going to have one role, which I'll explain soon. So don't worry too much about what the ghost number is. Just think of it as an integer associated to every open string vertex operator. And I'm going to say that it's defined in my topological field theory by this this equation here. Absolutely, yes. Yeah. So I can, if I had time, I could do a derivation of what this really is. I could prove that this is true, given what I've just done, but I don't have time to go through the proof. Again, it's a bit messy. I'm going to say that I'm going to claim that this is true. At the moment I'm talking about A brains, but it's going to be, but I'm going to follow this exact language in B brains right now. Okay. Oh, absolutely, yeah, sorry. Oh, gosh. Let me do B brains. I should never. So let me switch straight over to B brains. They're determined to trip me up on A brains. So I claim that the same thing is going to be true for D brains, for B brains, where I now associate these integers with vector bundles over the whole of the space. Okay, so that's my picture. Yeah. Right. So this is an open string. You see, the reason why it gets a bit puzzled between A brains and B brains, the fact I've written my brains as sub-manifolds is as if it were A brains. What I really want you to do is to think of this as B brains. So these are both vector bundles living over the entire space. But an open string can go from one to the other. And that open string vertex operator is going to have ghost number given by this. M and N are the numbers which were A over pi and B over pi, which were for the A brain. I haven't told you yet how to compute them for the B brain, but I'm going to tell you in gory detail how to compute them soon. But they are just numbers associated with the B brain, so I haven't told you exactly how to calculate them yet. Well, Well, there's going to be an underlying discrete gauge symmetry now of this topological field theory, which will correspond to shifting all of these integers, I think. No, but that's shifting both at the same time. Yeah. Well, I'll ask your question again when I give the example, and then we can see exactly where it's going.
You're only talking about the relative difference between the integers.
Right.
Not the absolute one.
So right. So there's definitely a gauge symmetry of shifting M and N by the same amount. I mean, that's a trivial symmetry of this theory. What always matters is the relative difference of M and N. Yeah, well, hopefully this is going to become clearer when I come to the example. No, I'm not, because sadly not, because that would take me a little bit too long. But I just claim that it can be done. But again, it's getting messy in the details of a conformal field after I think. Yeah, I thought about doing it when I was writing my notes, and about the fifth page of the notes I thought, oh, this is just hopeless. So, and also, I don't think it's written that particularly well. Mike's papers mention it.
I think it's the basis.
Yeah, it is. This is key to Mike's program, that these integers are there. It's not a very difficult computation, it's just long. I mean, in fact, there might be an easy there might be an easy way of doing it. I was thinking when I wrote my notes first that there must be an easy way of doing it. I couldn't think of a quick way of doing it, but you can definitely prove it.
Can you just say what it is?
these ghost numbers, M and M, come from the some currents that lived in the untwisted theory. So there's a definite notion of what a U1 charge of a given vertex operator in the untwisted theory is. Right, right. So what you've got to show is that these numbers M and M do indeed come from that current. So there's a definite computation you can do going from the untwisted theory to the twisted theory to find that the U1 currents are indeed given by these shifts. Sure, right. But they're very closely tied to each other. Yeah. Right, absolutely, right. Right. Okay.
Sorry, can I ask a very simple question about the B9 question? What is an example that leads you to think about vector bundles as opposed to geometrical structures? Can you just say that briefly? I mean, it seems like there you end up having a sixth ring, basically, and not configuring just a lower dimensional ring.
I said that I was going to restrict myself to six brains to make life easier. Nothing made me restrict myself to six brains. Oh, well, that comes, I said yesterday, from the fact that you've got to think of the B field as a gerb. The B field, just to get the gauge invariance of the B field right, something's got to live on the end of the string. And the simplest thing to put there is a line bundle.
All right, Paul, can't you
get a line bundle? I'm going to derive that fact. But at the moment, I'm just doing vector bundles. Yeah. Okay, so what our B model therefore is going to be is let so my vector bundles, I'm going to have an any number of vector bundles, each of them labeled by a different integer. Now, the motivation is pretty much what Mike just said. I'm now going to switch from vector bundles to sheaves. Everything's going to be phrased in terms of sheaves from now on. So instead of a vector bundle, I'm going to have a locally free sheaf. And a technical point, only a finite number of summands are non-zero. we want our vector bundle to have a finite number of dimensions, so even though n is running from minus infinity to infinity, I'm only going to let a finite number be non-trivial. So an open string vertex operator is in, well, it's in this group here, but if I go from vector bundles to sheaves, I can call this axed Q of E, which EM to EN. Okay, that's just the sheafified version of this. If you don't know what X means, then just think of it as this. I've just written it in a different way. Okay, so where are we? We've got a topological field theory of B brains. All we know about are six brains with vector bundles on them. Can we generalize? Sorry? I've done nothing more than what Witten did, except add this. I don't have any complexes yet. All I have is a sum of vector bundles. But a vector bundle is the same data as a locally free sheaf. I don't have complexes yet. All that X is doing is playing the role of this. So I really haven't done much more than Witten did yet. All I've done is add the M and N, which I claim I can derive, even though I didn't, from the worksheet code. Okay, well, that's all I've done.
X is
the same thing as H0Q. Yeah, it's just the same result that sheaf cohomology is Dolbeau cohomology. Okay. Sorry. it really is the same thing as whatever as the thing on the top of that board. My curly E's are all the possible locally free sheaves that I'm including in this theory.
Yeah,
one is labeled by the integer m, and one is labeled by the integer n.
Right, so which is m and which is
em? Well, in this one, em is playing the role of e, and en is playing the role of f. Oh yeah, I guess if you don't know x, then that might be a problem. Yeah, the left and right is the same. Okay, the e dual is the same as that one, and f is the same. I want to call it en because fn is going to play a role soon. For every pair of integers m and n, there's a bunch of open strings which go from em to en, and these are the vertex operators that correspond. En is one of the vector bundles in the big sum. So I've got a huge vector bundle which consists of a sum of other vector bundles. Each of those other bundles is labeled by an integer between minus infinity and infinity, which is labeling this ghost number shift. This is a topological field theory, so it's some choice. Okay. Pardon?
You refer to this thing as a vertex.
This is an open. This is a vertex operator for an open string being inserted on the boundary of the world sheet, which is going to correspond to an open string going from D brain E to D brain F. If I want the sum of all possible vertex operators, yes.
Are you saying that you're representing a brain by a vector bundle? You're representing a collection of brains by
This is a collection of brains given by a graded vector bundle. Fine, yes. That's definitely one clean way of saying it. Okay. Well, you'd count that as, you would add them together and count that as one term in the sum. Yeah. Now, you can deform a topological field theory by adding an operator to the action. Well, I need to write down the integral. I mean, roughly speaking, S is going to go to what S was plus the integral of some operator, O say, over the world sheet. This would be true for an open, for a closed string vertex operator, anyway. So this is a well-known method of deforming a topological field theory. Given a topological field theory, there are fields within it which can be used as deformations of that theory. Now, Gauss number one operators maintain a relationship with the untwisted theory. You see, I can take any old operator and I can always deform a topological field theory by it. But most of the time, that topological field theory which would lose its interpretation as being a twisted version of an n equals 2 theory. So,
you mean an integral over the bulk or integral over the bound?
Well, as I said, this is for a closed string vertex operator. I'm doing. Yeah. so, if I take my Gauss number one vertex operators, they're special in as much as I can deform by those, and they keep the topological field theory as a twisted version of an n equals 2 theory. So they're somehow more physical. They're the better deformations to use. So I'm going to consider my Gauss number one open string vertex operators and use those to deform my topological field theory to something more general. Now, I can't literally do this because it's on the vertex, so I need to be a bit cleverer. But I can still do a deformation of the theory by an open string vertex operator. Now let's just list what the Gauss number one vertex operators are. That's certainly a Gauss number one vertex operator. Yeah, I said. Okay. I can write this if it makes people happier. Okay. That's the way that I add a. If phi is a boundary vertex operator, I can add this term into the action.
Phi is Gauss number
one, right.
Okay,
G is the other supersymmetry that didn't turn into Q.
Right.
Okay.
So that's like the end, I guess.
And that's
right. No, this just goes over the boundary. This is, perhaps D tau would be better or something. Okay. So, that's a Gauss number one operator. This is a Gauss number one operator. This is a Gauss number one operator. And if I want Calabi-Yau three folds, the only other one is this one. So potentially any of these open strings can be used to deform my topological field theory to something more general. Now, let's see if we recognize any of these. Well, for those of you who know about ext, you'll recognize that ext1 of a locally free sheaf back to itself is actually the same thing as a first-order deformation of that sheaf. So this is actually a deformation that we already know about. Okay. An obvious deformation of the topological field theory I gave you is to just deform the data that I gave you, namely what these vector bundles are. And that's precisely what this guy is going to do here. Okay? So that one's kind of boring. Let's focus on this one. Let's consider what these do. And I'm going to show later on that actually just focusing on these actually gives you all the others anyway. So this is like the master one. If we consider these deformations, we're going to get all the others for free. And I'll show that later. So now ext0 is otherwise known as HOM. So what this open string vertex operator is nothing more than a map, which I'll call D subscript n, from en to en plus 1. That's what this open string vertex operator looks like. That's what I'm going to use to deform my topological field theory. Now, using this deformation, applying this deformation, this deforms Q. That should come as no surprise. My Q was some symmetry of the topological field theory. It was a BRST symmetry. It turns out that if I add some open string vertex operators in to act as a deformation of a theory, then that's going to change what my symmetry was. It's just going to change Q. Now, I think I come to the last black box I'm using in this talk. One can then show, again, I don't have time to show it, unfortunately. That Q becomes, let's call this Q old, plus D applied to the start of the string, plus D applied to the end of the string. Now, I'm being a bit nasty here because I'm mixing up the notion of a derivative and something you take the anti-commutator with. Think of Q as something that you just... Q is going to be the role of... Q is going to be the thing that was playing the role of the D. Well, D bar. This Q old is the thing that was playing the role of the Dolbeau cohomology. Okay? That's what our old Q was. I showed that in the old topological field theory, before I did the deformation, that the cohomology being used by Q was nothing more than the D-bar type of cohomology. Now, this deformation I get by applying this open string vertex operator is going to deform this notion of Q by acting on D at the start of the string and then acting on D at the end of the string. That's what is going to happen. Okay, I think this is the last time in the talk where I'm going to have to say, take my word for it. There's a long way of analyzing with CFT.
D bar is zero on cohomology.
Let me. Right, that's why these spaces were in the cohomology, but I've now shifted what the...
I'm asking, where is this sum of
three operators? It's going to act on the... Oh, that's a good question. It acts on the space of all possible maps between sheaves, really. I mean, perhaps it'll be...
It's not like D of start plus D of end is acting on these X.
No, no. This is acting on the basic fields, and I've got to find out what the cohomology of this is to find out what my new field content is going to be. I've deformed what Q was, so my open string vertex operators are no longer in these groups. It's all been shifted. Okay. Right, so this is a first order deformation. I'm beginning with a topological field theory. I know what I'm doing. I'm doing a tiny deformation, which is still described in terms of the original theory, but I've now changed the theory totally. So the Q operator is now shifted. I now need to work out what the cohomology of the new Q is to actually tell you what the field content now is. I'm going to tell you what it is. It's a complicated answer. I'm going to tell you. Right. Right. You could do that. Right. I need this to square to zero. So that's the first constraint. Well, D is something that acts at the end of a string. D is something that's acting on a D-brain, which is where a string ends. So I apply D to one end of the string, and then I apply D to the other end of the string.
Is that D the same?
Yes. Yeah, this is D sub N. It's the thing that's acting on the D-brain. So this should be D sub N at one end and D sub M at the other end, if it was going from M to N. So the first trick is Q squared equals zero implies, if you just go through the algebra, dn plus 1, dn is zero for all n. That's the condition I need, that my new Q is still something that can act as a BRST operator in a topological field theory. So what do my Ds look like? Well, I have En. D is a
star is like a
right. D is a holomorphic map from this sheaf to this sheaf. Yeah. Yeah, it was in HOM. This is holomorphic maps from this holomorphic bundle to this holomorphic bundle. A sheaf. So it's a map of sheaves. Right, well, this is. Right, right, right. This is a three-dimensional complex, as I'm going to show. I've got three different boundary operators. So this is a triple complex. Right. Right. So this is a triple complex here. Because I was just labeling which D-brains it's being applied to. If D is mapping En to En plus 1, if I act again a second time, then it's Dn plus 1 by my definition of what N is here. I'm just saying that D is being applied twice. I mean, if you want, you can not write those subscripts and just think of applying D twice. Dn plus 1 maps to En plus 2. Okay. It's about time. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, everywhere. Yeah, it's all of the Ds at once. So in particular, I've got a complex. So that's the first statement. a D brain, which originally was just a locally free sheaf, is now a complex of locally free sheaves once I've used this deformation. Sorry? I've got an infinite number of E's, and so it's as if I had a whole bunch of D brains. Now I've turned them into one D brain because it's just one big complex.
Actually, I have a finite
group. Yeah, okay. Or I could just turn on some of the D's and be left with two different D brains, which weren't mixing. Okay. So, might have to take 5 more minutes than I should do. Q is now a triple complex. Well, it's now associated to a triple complex. So this is where we start having fun with some homological algebra. So let's explain what this triple complex looks like exactly. So first of all, let 0 goes to F an injective resolution. Now, those of you in the audience who don't know homological algebra will have to take a snooze the rest of this talk, because I really have no alternative for the next 5 minutes to delve a little deeply into some homological algebra. So this is an injective resolution of Fn for any locally free sheaf Fn, okay? So if phi is in Hom of Em Fnp, then Q0, cube old, applied to phi, is, put some labels on here. Sorry, right, well, if a sheaf has two labels, it means it's an injective object in the category of sheaves. So these Fs are much nastier things than this. This is a locally free sheaf. This is something more abstract, which I need to define the injective, this complex. So it's as if I begin with this, and then I use this sheaf to give me possible values for these nasty sheaves here. Yeah, I'm just messing around with the notation to distinguish a bit better between my two sheaves. F is a locally free sheaf that can play the role of what Curly E was. I haven't quite finished writing what I was going to write yet, so make it clearer. So those are my maps of injective sheaves. I P phi, which is in Hom. Yeah, let me. Yes, it is, but I can't write it as E because. So I'm now going to call my second sheaf F rather than E, which I'm perfectly free to do. F, you can make the same thing as E if you want. The reason I've called it a different name is that I might make it so that F really is different to E. I may have started off with a whole bunch of locally free sheaves. I've switched on a bunch of D's, but those D's haven't totally mixed up my locally free sheaves. I can pick out one subset of sheaves, which the D's are mapping within, and another set of sheaves, which the D's are mapping in. I'll call the first set E, and I can call this the second set F. So F can actually be different to E, morally speaking. Or you can just say that F is E, if you want. Well, this is the old Q old was, when I was talking in the language of vector bundles, was D bar. Now the result that Dolbeau cohomology is the same thing as sheaf cohomology means that this is true. All Q old is doing is shifting me one step up the injective resolution of my sheaf F, which is what the definition of sheaf cohomology is. So that's what Q old is doing. Yep. Yeah, I'm now working in terms of shoes.
The cohomology is the same, doesn't it?
I've shifted language, yeah. So, right, my chains are different. But the cohomology was the... Sorry? It's Q old. Right, absolutely, yeah. So I've changed language from vector bundles to sheaves, which I'm allowed to do because the cohomology, which all that mattered, was the same. Yeah, but all that the topological field theory knew about was what the cohomology was. So I'm perfectly free to say, oh, let's pretend that the topological field theory was actually in terms of sheaves rather than vector bundles. Sorry? I'm not sure I understand the question. I've written down something whose information content, at least before I did a deformation, was identical to the topological field theory. But the cohomology was there, which is all the topological field theory knew about.
Is there an injective resolution cohomology with a Dolbeau resolution, and this is just a generalization?
Okay. It might be possible to use all this language in the vector bundle language, but actually I doubt it. I mean, I could try and change it back to vector, but let me just write in terms of sheaves. Yeah. Oh, okay, good. Okay. Okay, sure. But the derived category is normally written in terms of coherent sheaves, not in terms of vector bundles, which is why I can make life easier by going to sheaves at this point. Right, fine. Right.
I was trying to get you to describe it in terms of the forms you would use, but now you're giving
I'm giving it right.
Where Q, where the sum of these three operators will act as an operator.
Right, absolutely. Right. So let me just finish writing this down. D start on phi is equal to phi composed with D M minus 1, which is in HOM of E M minus 1 F N comma, and that should be P, and D end phi is D N applied to phi, which is in HOM E N E M F N plus 1 P. So this really is a triple complex, okay? Every element is labeled by three numbers, m, n, and p, and every one of these differential operators, q, d start, and d end, shift me either up one or down one in this triple complex. So think of a lattice in three dimensions. Yeah, right, yeah. So, to find the total cohomology, namely to find what the actual operator contents of this topological field theory is, I need to apply a spectral sequence twice. I've got a triple complex, I've got a boundary operator, which is the sum of those three different boundary operators, and the way that you find the total version of the cohomology in a double complex is to apply spectral sequence once. So I've got a triple complex, so I apply a spectral sequence twice. Okay, now you'll be pleased to know I won't take you through the details of this. Yeah, that's homework. So I'll just state what the result is and I can start. So the total cohomology is given by a thing that's actually well known. It's called hyper-Xed. If people work in the derived category, they'll know what hyper-Xed is, but let me just give you a definition. So so take so from now on I'm going to use a bullet to represent a whole complex. So F bullets means a complex going from negative F's to positive F's. it starts off at minus infinity, goes all the way up to infinity. But with only a finite number of non-zero terms. and then we replace each Fn by an injective resolution. And collapse to a single complex again. So what I mean by that is I'm going to write Fn injective is a sum of all terms such that k plus n equals, k plus p is n, fk comma p. Okay, so this double index here represents the fact that I've taken an injective resolution, just like last time. I'm then going to put a subscript injective to mean I add all these up so that the total degree is n. So that's a definition of Fn injective. Sorry?
So that bounded from below?
It's bounded from below, not from above, because there's an injective resolution. And then define HOM P E bullets, F bullets. So this is between two complexes, is the sum N HOM then this forms a complex of linear vector spaces and HOM P E F is the cohomology of this complex. And this is the hyper-X group. So this is where the new open string vertex operators live. And this P is the new ghost number. So this is an open string from the D-brain described by the complex E to the D-brain defined by the complex F. And it's a linear vector space, which is where the open strings vertex operators should live. It's the Hilbert space, if you like. It's the Hilbert space of these vertex operators. and that's where it lives. So what I've done is I've... It is finite dimensional, yeah. Well, if E and F are suitably finite, which they are in our case, then it will be finite dimensional. So what I've done is I've replaced a D-brain by a whole complex of locally free sheaves. And in doing so, I've had to change what an open string is, but I've told you what an open string is. I can do a computation of the vector space that represents the space of all open string operators by going through this story here. Okay, that's a good place to stop. Thanks.